I'm speaking with Professor Elizabeth Sanders of the Cornell University Department of Government. She is also a member of the American Studies program. This semester, Professor Sanders is teaching the course The American Presidency. Today, we'll be talking about last week's election and her viewpoint on President-elect Trump's victory. Professor Sanders, thanks for talking with me today.
You're very welcome.
I noticed that your main research interests are in American political development and popular politics. This year's presidential election was almost a study in how populist movements such as those run by Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump competed against a more establishment movement run by Hillary Clinton. Did you predict that a populist would win in this election?
I did not. I wish I had. I will say that I probably thought it was more likely than many of my colleagues, just by virtue of keeping tabs on the unhappiness and of being a Bernie Sanders supporter myself and knowing how people felt about his candidacy and predicting early on that he would do much better than people thought in the Democratic primaries. But other than that, I started watching the returns like everybody else, thinking Hillary would be coasting in, and it didn't happen. And, you know, there's a sense in which any uprising against a powerful establishment is a good thing in its own right. When you forget about 40, 45% of the population who are doing very badly in the globalist project that elites came up with back in the 90s, and you just kind of write them off, yes, of course, it's a democracy, they're going to rebel. Give them a Bernie Sanders, they'll take him. But the Democratic Party, as we now know from WikiLeaks, pulled out all the stops to block him. And that's one of the big mistakes that were made by elites in this election, because by crushing Bernie Sanders, they made Trump's victory inevitable, given that there was a large group of unhappy people looking for anybody who was anti-establishment, in spite of any other characteristics, in spite of the fact that Bernie was a socialist, in spite of the fact that Trump is probably the most certainly the most obnoxious, reprehensible personality who's ever run for high office. I think people voted for both of them in spite of those sort of normally red flag things, because there was just so much unhappiness there, and the establishment in both parties seemed completely unlikely to deal with it. They were on their tracks, and they didn't care about those people. So in that sense, it shouldn't have surprised us as much as it did.
I'm wondering about the unhappiness of the voting populace. How extensive do you really think unhappiness was in the group that voted for Trump? So we're seeing now that maybe 45% of the people who voted for Trump. Do you really think that all those people were unhappy about how they were doing in the economy today?
Certainly not. I think there were, because in the end, of course, a lot of Republicans came back to their party, held their noses and came back to it. And those were probably people who were very comfortable. I mean, you know, people with college educations, a lot of them did come back in the end to Trump. So if you just look at the final set of people, it's kind of a mixed bag. But what is unusual is a Republican Party candidate finding the opportunity or being compelled to reach out to the white working class in an economic way. That's pretty unusual. And so I do think that that group of unhappy people, we don't have a good, like we call them downwardly mobile white males, but that too is a very broad category, because 43% of women voted mm-hmm. for Trump too. So we don't want to be too reductionist in the way we characterize them. But I think that the central motivation that gave us rebellions in both parties, and there was a big overlap between Sanders and Trump voters, and probably a lot of Sanders people voted for Trump. The other thing one has to recognize is a whole lot of Obama voters voted for Trump. They voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012 because they wanted change, because they were miserable, because they weren't doing well. He was their great hope. And, you know, when he was gone and hadn't done as much for them as they had hoped, and this crazy Trump guy came along, he was the last game in town. This was desperation, but it was also a kind of great little d democratic cry of anguish. And I think the people who had really figured this out were certainly not the statisticians who were working on exit polls from 20 states, when we know now that low-income people tend not to respond to exit pollers. They'll just run away. They won't talk to them. So you end up thinking you've got a much more high-income group than you really have voting in those elections. But the people who got it were the people doing what I call political anthropology. And there was a lot of this around. There's a sociologist named Airlie Russell Hochschild who wrote an article called No Country for White Men in Mother Jones. And she went to Louisiana and she talked to these Trump supporters and really figured out what their grievances were and came up with a very rich and nuanced picture of them in a state where, after all, one thing people should notice is David Duke, if you wanted an out-and-out racist, former head of the Klan, got 3% of the vote in the Senate race. Okay, it was not very popular. So, you know, if you're looking for pure racism, that didn't really do well in this election. I don't think that's what people were about. Hochschild talks about people feeling a kind of resentment, you could call it racial resentment, because the government seemed to care about African Americans, it seemed to care about Hispanics, and there were all kinds of programs to help them, but there was nothing for white men and women who had lost their jobs. And the, you know, there's supposed to be programs if you've lost your job because of trade, and a lot of them have. There's supposed to be programs to help them, and it's a measly like $10,000 for a year. What are you going to do? You're going to go to college and get a degree in computer science when you're 55 and you're laid off and that's all you have to spend. There was no help for them. And there was a resentment, like, nobody cares about us. And if you look, as several people have pointed out, if you look at counties where people's average family income is going down, lifespans are going down, drug addiction is going up fast, suicides are going up, if you find the counties where those four things happen, that's where your Trump voters are. So yes, I think the unhappiness was very real.
So just focusing on unhappiness and the voters who are affected by all of these changes, why do you think that those voters, for example, don't notice that not a whole lot was happening in Congress to help their case? There wasn't a lot going on in terms of writing legislation that would provide more jobs that might alleviate their pain and the decrease in their income. You know, I think that at least for people who listen to the news, it was evident that Obama was blocked in a lot of his efforts to get things passed that would help, you know, that would help the working person. But
what
he was
stymied.
What do you think
those things were, though? What was he trying to do that the Republicans blocked him on?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I would say that the Affordable Care Act was blocked all the way, and it was, and there were lots of votes to try to prevent it from going through.
But it did pass, and it was in effect. And I think the main problem with the Affordable Care Act is that giant rate increases were going through. I mean, I know there's some, I know there are people in my family getting mm-hmm. Obamacare, and rates were going up starkly so that people thought they would no longer be able to afford it. And I think that helped Trump win, saying he would get rid of it and replace it. But if you look at what Obama did, some sponsored some landmark legislation in the first few years, and there was re-regulation of Wall Street, there was the Affordable Care Act, there was the stimulus bill. None of them went as far as they might have. And if you look at the crew of people he brought in to be his economic advisors, pretty much the same people Bill Clinton had, right? They're bankers. Mm-hmm. Larry Summers kept the stimulus very small. We know that from investigative journalism of the Obama administration. So I think from the point of view of the downwardly mobile working class, they didn't see Obama doing anything for them. What they saw him doing was supporting a trade treaty that was a complete abomination, that went farther toward rewarding big corporations and hurting workers than any other trade treaty. And there are two of them, the mm-hmm. TPP and the TTIP with Europe. And these are the most remarkably pro-corporate, anti-worker, anti-environment trade treaties anybody ever came up with. So they saw Obama putting everything behind passing that. And they saw him acting on behalf of immigrants. One could obviously see his actions both ways. But having immigrants come in large numbers and come in and stay at the same time that manufacturing jobs are crashing. If you look at those two graphs, right? Immigration up to historically high, almost the highest ever, but 1890s, a little bit higher. And that's going up at the same time manufacturing jobs are crashing. That's a formula for a working class rebellion. And it's happening in other countries too.
So I just was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about Trump and his appeal. So he's a reality television star. And I'm wondering, does his victory in any way echo Ronald Reagan's appeal in 1980 and 1984?
You know, the way it could echo that, it's an interesting question, is they were both entertainers. And that helped with name recognition. It helped that people knew who they were, that they had this kind of persona that was at least, I guess, entertaining. I've never once seen Trump's show, so I have no way to judge it. But, Ronald Reagan had done commercials for General Electric and had been a movie star. I mean, I guess that helps a little. And they were both really outsiders, though in Reagan's case, he had held public office as a Republican in California and was certainly much more a party guy than Trump. But I think that helped a little bit. I think the main thing is just that after Bernie Sanders was crushed by the Democratic machine, there was nobody else left to cast a protest vote with than Donald Trump. And I think he won as the last guy standing, not because people liked him. I mean, you know, you see all these interviews with women who voted for Trump and they despise him. They despise the things he said about women. Why would anybody like that? But he was the only anti-establishment possibility at that point for people who just saw an ongoing misery. And I think they were very extremely critical of their Congress people. I don't think Paul Ryan was speaking to Trump voters. Do away with Social Security, cut taxes and regulations for wealthy people and corporations. I don't think they approved of that. I think it was a bipartisan anti-establishment vote.
Can we talk a little bit more about the women voters that supported Trump? How psychologically, like, how do voters balance this feeling, like you said, that they really dread the candidate because of his viewpoints against women, but at the same time they can't bear to vote for Hillary Clinton because she's too establishment and maybe too elitist for them? How do they balance that?
I think you just answered the question, and it is really hard. I certainly felt that as a woman. How could anybody vote for a person who has the most backward, abominable attitudes about women? It's just completely appalling. And I think women who voted for him, 43% of women, had to hold their noses and think about the economic health of their families and what the prospects their children were going to have. I think they just held their nose and did it for flat out economic reasons, that nobody gave them any hope and they were dying and they were going to keep dying. Unless somebody reversed that, at least Trump, these are the two things he will do. He's going to cut the competition of low-wage immigrants with American workers, and he's made it impossible, along with Bernie Sanders, said the same thing, to pass those trade treaties. So, you know, he starts off the bat with those two policy possibilities. And I think if you look at the Trump voters, they cared much more about the economic side of that, the factory closings. They really weren't all that. I think they put immigration, like, it was number fifth in their priorities, and economics pretty much soaked it all up. But, you know, Trump came up with that package of things. And there's a lot of there's a lot of contention among economists in how much immigration really hurts.